This week on Making Contact.
While many people feared military intervention by the United States in Colombia because it could be another Vietnam, the intervention in Colombia was necessary not only to control drug trafficking and the guerrillas, but also in order to control Venezuela.
In 1999, when the mammoth military aid and training package known as Plan Colombia first came into being, many critics cautioned that more U.S. troops, more helicopters, and more U.S. advisors were certain to mean greater U.S. military involvement in Colombia's decades-old civil conflict. Those opposed to Plan Colombia made the case that the so-called war on drugs in that South American country was just a cover for eliminating leftist guerrilla groups. 4 years and several billion dollars later, war continues, and the cocaine trade still flourishes. The Bush administration and top brass of the Pentagon maintain that Colombia is a top priority, not only to fight drugs, but to enhance national security in the United States. Is there more to U.S. policy on Colombia than meets the eye? On this edition of Making Contact, we hear from leaders in Colombian civil society about what they view as Plan Colombia's broader strategy, regional dominance by U.S. military and economic interests. I'm Philip Babbitt, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. Civilians in Colombia are very much caught in the crossfire of Latin America's longest-running civil conflict. Now in its 40th year, the war has claimed the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, and there are currently more than 2 million internally displaced Colombians. Far from a simple battle between left and right ideological forces, Colombia's civil war involves guerrilla armies, paramilitary units, and the Colombian military. Add to the mix the lucrative cocaine trade, a highly orchestrated system of kidnapping and extortion, collusion among Colombian battalions and paramilitary units, the financing of private armies by transnational corporations, and billions of dollars in U.S. aid, and you've got enough money and incentives to keep the conflict going in perpetuity. At least that's the assessment of many leaders in Colombian civil society who've seen peace process after peace process fail. Ricardo Escavilla is a Mennonite pastor and works as a peace negotiator. He's talked with the leadership of Colombia's two main guerrilla groups, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, and the National Liberation Army, or ELN. He's also met with top-ranking government and military officials and with leaders of the United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia, or the AUC, the largest paramilitary organization. During the administration of President Andrés Pastrana, peace talks between the Colombian government and the FARC appeared to be moving forward, but in 2001, the talks broke down. Esquivia says that although this could be viewed as a setback, it was actually in the interests of the government, the FARC, and the economic powers in Colombia to keep the war going.
Pienso que ahí en ese caso ganaron los tres. Ganó la FARC, ganó.
So I think in this case, all three groups won. The FARC, the government, and the establishment, because they achieved all that they wanted, which was for the war to continue and for there to be more confrontation. And the United States as well was able to achieve its goals of maintaining and creating its stronger presence here and expanding it into neighboring Andean countries. I say that because it's true that Colombia is not the most important country for the United States. Within this hemisphere, it's the only country that has this kind of conflict going on. And because of the geographical position of Colombia, it's crucial for the development of U.S. negotiations with the rest of Latin America. And because in this time of formation of trade blocs, like the European bloc and the formation of Asian bloc, the United States has to develop its own bloc. And a government like the United States, in trying to strengthen its hegemony, its political and military power needs to firmly control its backyard. Also, Latin America signifies for the United States almost 600 million people that could constitute a strong market.
Esquivia adds that left-leaning governments in Venezuela, Brazil, and Ecuador could make it more difficult for the United States to expand its economic and military interests in the Andean region.
What you see is these U.S. policies of intervention are directed towards increasing the war as a justification for establishing a U.S. military presence in the region. Because if they were really trying to do the opposite, trying to end the war, then they would have to understand that peace is a fruit of justice, and they wouldn't send weapons. Instead, they'd be sending us advisors and people who can help our production improve. And they would also open up their markets to our products, because drug trafficking is an economic function. And as long as someone in the United States is buying these drugs from Colombians, then they're going to produce them. And so they need to attack demand in the United States if the supply is going to decrease in Colombia.
Elected in 2001, the current president, Álvaro Uribe, came to power promising to crack down on illegal armed groups, both the guerrillas and the paramilitaries, and to combat so-called narco-terrorists. As an ally of the U.S. war on terrorism, Uribe enjoys good relations with the Bush administration.
Y también para mantener buena la relación con el gobierno de Estados Unidos, tiene que abrir sus mercados y entrar a...
And also, in order to maintain a good relationship with the U.S. government, Colombia has to open its markets. There has to be an opening of Colombian markets. But what consequences has this brought to our country? This is a country that used to produce potatoes, rice, corn, wheat, and also had good livestock production. But with this market opening, now all those products come to us from the United States, and they're sold here at a better price. And why are the prices better? Because while the U.S. government demands an opening of markets from Colombia, the U.S. borders are closed to Colombian products. And the borders aren't closed only to Colombian products. The U.S. government allows for this exchange of goods. Where the U.S. is sending goods to Latin American countries, it doesn't allow people from those countries to come into the United States. It's completely closed. There is no way to get visas. You can see how these economic treaties that they're trying to carry out continue to increase the war, because they say that the war is within the struggle against drug trafficking, and the military intervention of the United States government was originally said to be designed to end illicit crop production. But if the campesinos were to have someone to buy their products, if they were to receive economic support, if they were to have health care and highways, then they would stay where they are and work and not get involved in war and not go anywhere else. But if the country is not buying their products and if the state is not investing in them socially, then what can the campesinos do?
¿Qué puede hacer el campesino?
Grow coca, particularly as the Colombian market is flooded with heavily subsidized U.S. agricultural products. It's impossible for Colombian farmers to compete with U.S. agribusinesses, so many campesinos have resorted to growing small plots of coca leaves, the raw material for coca paste, which is used to produce cocaine. Colombia supplies more than 80% of the cocaine bought in the United States, and it's the world's number one producer of the drug. A primary response by U.S. and Colombian officials is crop eradication, using chemical mixtures to fumigate coca fields from the air. Nancy Sanchez has been studying the effects of Plan Colombia in the southern province of Putumayo, where crop eradication programs have been concentrated. A leader in the human rights movement in Colombia, Sanchez was a health educator working for the mayor of Puerto Aziz in Putumayo. She heard thousands of reports of severe illnesses and some deaths that resulted after sweeps of aerial fumigation.
En la primera fumigación, que fueron las del año 2000, realmente los efectos devastadores.
The first round of fumigations happened in 2000, and the effects were devastating. I don't understand why they ask for scientific proof when all that is needed is to go and see the Amazonian region where they have fumigated indiscriminately. We're accustomed to seeing this area lush and green and with animals everywhere, and it was just yellow. It was as though it had been raised. The people were developing all kinds of serious illnesses, especially the children.
Había desarrollado unas enfermedades muy, muy, muy graves de piel, los niños sobre todo. Las diarreas intensas, no controladas en los niños. Hubo denuncias de muertes.
Lots of different skin rashes, uncontrolled diarrhea in the children. And there were denunciations at that time from some municipalities of children dying from these effects. We did field research, but again, we didn't have the technical methods that were necessary to conclusively prove the connection between the fumigations and all of these things that were happening to people's health in terms of skin rashes and diarrhea and this widespread destruction of the environment.
Y la devastación del medio ambiente era impresionante.
The Colombian government distributed forms for campesinos to fill out to lodge complaints about the health effects from aerial fumigations.
Formas en esa oportunidad se diseñó un formato para recibir las quejas de los miles y miles de campesinos.
Another thing that happened around this time was that forms were produced for complaints to be registered by campesinos about effects from the fumigations. And those complaints would be brought to local human rights workers in each municipality. We received 3,000 of these complaints in just two municipalities in the Guamúes Valley, in La Hormiga and San Miguel, where we were doing a study. We looked at the health effects on those complaints, and we compared them with studies of health prior to the fumigations. And we saw that the indexes for skin rashes and diarrhea went way up after the fumigations. So we brought this information to the Colombian government and also to the U.S. Embassy, and the response that they gave us was that this was an unhealthy environment that is very humid in this region, and so these kinds of illnesses are basically natural.
The initial rounds of fumigations under Plan Colombia were much worse than anything the campesinos in Putumayo had experienced before. The method had been used in the past to eradicate marijuana crops, but this time, says Sanchez, the effects were much worse. The concentration of the active chemical in the herbicide, glyphosate, was higher, she says, and there was a new additive.
Y además le añadieron un químico que se llama Cosmoflux. El Cosmoflux, al parecer,
in addition, they also added another chemical called Cosmoflux. Apparently, Cosmoflux is a chemical that is being used in order for the herbicide to go through the waxy layer of the coca leaf. They'd had this problem in prior fumigations because the campesinos, in their great creativity, had put a certain kind of honey on the leaves of the plants. And then, all they would have to do after the fumigations is wash off the leaves so that nothing would happen to the plant.
Meanwhile, a far less intense campaign has been directed at the drug labs and cartels responsible for producing and distributing cocaine. We'll have more on that in a few moments. You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or you would like to contact any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. The legendary Cali and Medellin cartels of the 1980s and 1990s are no more. Clashes among drug kingpins, law enforcement stings, and shifts in production and distribution schemes have decentralized cocaine trafficking. Instead of two or three major cartels, there are dozens of smaller operations, says Ricardo Vargas, an expert on drug policy with the non-governmental organization Acción Andina.
Es interesante porque esto lo previó un par de analistas de Estados Unidos muy interesantes, su nombre no me acuerdo ahorita, de que eso era lo que iba a pasar antes de la guerra de los carteles.
This is really interesting because a group of analysts from the United States predicted this before the war between the cartels even happened. Small and medium-sized organized groups started to appear, between 150 and 170, according to figures from the National Police, disseminated in various cities in Colombia. It's these organizations that currently sustain the internal demand for this basic paste, and the majority of these organizations have not been affected at all by Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia concentrates on the cultivation of illicit crops, and it leaves aside the minute investigation of these new groups. Who are they? How are they organized? What is their structure? There's a huge hole in intelligence relative to the new structures of narco-trafficking in Colombia. With the growth of internal demand for coca paste and the growth of production of coca, Colombia became more visible in terms of the production of illicit crops and less visible, almost invisible, in the area of narco-trafficking.
El país se hizo más visible alrededor del tema de cultivos ilícitos y se hizo invisible alrededor del tema del narcotráfico.
Vargas adds that the political and economic power of the drug cartels is not to be underestimated.
De la cantidad de recursos que se han lavado a través de la compra de tierras, apartamentos, casas, el Estado no ha podido lograr la extinción de dominio.
Of the amount of resources that have been laundered through buying land, apartments, and houses, the state hasn't been able to get control of even 1% of these properties. Through the acquisition of land, these cartels have purchased almost 4 million hectares of land in this country, and through this have acquired very strong political, economic, and military control in many regions of the country. These cartels have been financing campaigns for governors, for representatives to the government, for mayors, members of Congress. And they also control private armies. Through the combination of this political, military, and economic power, they have been able to transform many different parts of this country for their own private interest. And the great displacement that Colombia suffers of more than 2 million people has to do with this fact. Displacement, almost always in the media, is shown as something that has to do with confrontations between the paramilitaries and the guerrillas. But a very important factor of this displacement has to do with the process of accumulating ownership of land and the acquisition of strategic areas by narco-traffickers. That's to say that war is a great business for narco-traffickers.
Donde el capital de narcotráfico sigue siendo un factor importantísimo. Es decir, la guerra es un gran negocio para el narcotráfico.
Vargas adds that this concentration of power in the hands of the drug cartels is a deep part of the problem in Colombia, one that's not adequately addressed by Plan Colombia. Instead, we see more Black Hawk helicopters, crack battalions, and fumigation runs, often coordinated by private U.S. military contractors. Economist and sociologist Hector Mondragon is a leading dissident in Colombia and works with the influential Mennonite Church. Tortured by the Colombian military in the 1970s for his peace activities, Mondragon lives in hiding to avoid death squads. He says that although U.S. and Colombian officials claim that crop eradication programs are effective, there's no stopping coca farming when there's high demand for cocaine and no economic opportunities for poor campesinos. Coca farmers simply find other plots of land to grow on when their crops are wiped out. But this has had an added benefit for U.S. military strategists looking to gain advantage in or near countries that border Colombia.
Do you believe that the wise leaders of the United States don't know that this is the case? But this is perfect. In a few years, there will be tons of people growing coca on the border with Brazil. So bingo. Plan Colombia arrives in the border region with Brazil, and everything turns out very nicely in order to carry out the method of the 1964 coup against Lula in Brazil. In the same way, whereas the initial primary focus of Plan Colombia was Putumayo, it's now Arauco, which is a border department with Venezuela. This is what's been declared a military zone, where there's new aid being offered in dollars for the military struggle in the region, and also the region in Colombia, where there's the most paramilitary violence, is the department called Norte de Santander, which is also on the border with Venezuela. In the capital of Norte de Santander, the city of Cucuta, last year there were more homicides than in Bogota even though the population of Cúcuta is one-tenth that of Bogota. And so the primary focus has switched from Putumayo, which remains very important, to this border region with Venezuela, which has become the primary focus of the military. But the primary focus can also shift to the border region with Brazil at an opportune time.
Mondragon points to efforts to destabilize the government of Venezuela's populist president, Hugo Chavez, as an example of U.S. power plays in the region. In December 2002, several months after a short-lived coup, Venezuela's state-run oil industry came to a standstill when the computerized routing and distribution system locked up. The system is run by a company called Intesa.
La compañía Intesa...
The Intesa company, the Venezuelan state, has some of the shares, but the other part of the shares and all of the technical management is owned by a United States company. It's called SAIC. Among the company's highest executives, there are three people who were formerly high-ranking people within the CIA, and they also have one ex-director of the National Security Council. And in addition, they have an admiral and a general. So a similar Trojan horse to the one that destroyed the oil company. We'll say the Trojan computer. This is a military action. And what Venezuela has been experiencing is part of a military action. And what we here in Colombia are experiencing is part of the same action.
Mondragon adds that the late U.S. Senator Paul Coverdale, who was a key supporter of U.S. aid to Colombia, made the Venezuela connection quite clear in a Washington Post op-ed piece.
Escribió en abril del año 2000, en abril 10, en el Washington Post, que aunque muchos temieran que...
He wrote in April 2000 in the Washington Post that while many people feared military intervention by the United States in Colombia because it could be another Vietnam, the intervention in Colombia was necessary not only to control drug trafficking and the guerrillas, but also in order to control Colombia, in order to control Venezuela. Because Venezuela is the primary exporter of oil to the United States within the Western Hemisphere. And so if the war against drugs was a pretext for the war against the guerrilla groups, we begin to see the war against the guerrilla groups is itself a pretext for war against other countries, not Colombia. Why was it that 2 days before the Venezuelan lockout began, Secretary of State Colin Powell arrived in Bogota? He was here on December 4th and he left on the 5th. There are rumors that he met in a building owned by the police with some of the leadership of the coup in Venezuela, including Pedro Carmona, and with one of the generals who was involved in the coup efforts in Venezuela, and with two or three Colombian generals. What explanation does this quick visit of Powell's to Bogota have? There was no need for further coordination with Colombia from the U.S. because President Uribe had been to Washington recently to do that coordination, meeting with Powell and Bush and others.
In October 2003, General James Hill, chief of the U.S. Southern Command, warned the Senate Foreign Relations Committee of a, quote, narco-terrorist spillover, and said that, quote, the future health of the region hinges upon what happens in Colombia. The Pentagon has also floated the idea that not only Colombia could be a safe haven for narco-terrorists and international terrorists, but also Venezuela, possibly paving the way for a public campaign to drum up support for military action. Hector Mondragon.
Entonces ustedes ven que así el Plan Colombia...
And so you can see why Plan Colombia has stopped being called Plan Colombia. It's now the Andean Initiative. And you see that they're building military bases in Manda in Ecuador and on the islands of Aruba and Curaçao, which are Dutch islands, just a few meters from the Colombian coast and not so many meters from the Venezuelan coast.
And in the south, U.S. policy could be paving the way for oil exploration and continent-wide infrastructure projects, say many observers. Nancy Sanchez says the fact that Campesinos and Putumayo are getting hit from all directions, fumigations, the guerrillas and the paramilitaries, adds credence to a long-held suspicion that there are efforts to depopulate southern Colombia.
Porque es un círculo, además de que le han fumigado al campesino la coca, que era un campesino, yo no estoy hablando de gran cultivador, sino el pequeño campesino.
Because it's a cycle. When I'm talking about the effects of the fumigations, I'm talking about the effects on campesinos, people with 2 or 3 hectares of coca, not large growers. And these campesinos would have their plantains and their cassava and all their basic food crops destroyed by the fumigations. But not only that, the fumigations would also mean that they would lose their access to financial resources that they would get through selling the coca. Because every 3 months or so, they'd be able to harvest the coca, and each harvest could get about $600, and they would pay for their studies, for their food. And without this, they have nothing, absolutely nothing, to live on. So in addition to the fact that the indigenous people and campesinos have to tolerate this and live with this situation, they also have to deal with the armed actors, the FARC and the paramilitaries pressuring them. Because these two groups, the FARC and the paramilitaries, they're not carrying out combat one against the other. They're actually attacking the people. The FARC comes into a community and it kills the people it says are collaborators with the paramilitary, and then they leave. And then the paramilitaries come in and they kill the people they say met with and collaborated with the FARC. And it becomes this cycle with the campesino standing in the middle with no idea of what to do.
Hector Mondragon says that Southern Colombia is a vital region for infrastructure projects that would provide the backbone for the hemispheric trade pact known as the Free Trade Area of the Americas. FTAA negotiations suffered a partial setback in Miami in November 2003, but bilateral trade agreements could fulfill the desire among business elites to string together one of the world's largest trading blocks.
In order to bring the FTAA to fruition, there's a whole plan for the development of infrastructure, which is broken down into 3 points, the first of which is Plan Puebla-Panama. The second is the interoceanic canal in the border region between Colombia and Panama, where the Trato River is, and the plan that's called IIRSA, which means the Initiative for the Integration of Infrastructure in the South American Region. This plan has as one of its principal objectives, for example, the linking of waterways. Through the connecting up, for example, of the Amazon River and the La Plata River, you'll be able to get from Buenos Aires or Montevideo up to the Amazon. And from the Amazon River to the north, you'll be able to get to Putumayo. And in Putumayo, there's a plan for a highway to the Pacific Ocean that would allow for that transit route to go all the way from Buenos Aires to the Pacific. And so in the end, Putumayo is not only important for its oil, but also for this plan of connecting routes of commerce.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact, a look at regional interests behind U.S. policy on Colombia. This has been edition number 5103. Thanks for listening. And special thanks to Sandra Alvarez, Philip Cryan, Ryan Calkins, and Ali Burry for translations. We had voiceover assistance from Jesus Solario, Sandra Alvarez, Gary Hyder, and Dan Turner. We have production assistance from Kimberly Ross. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for CD or cassette copies of this program. That's 800-529-5736. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Lisa Rubman is our executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, Amy Parmelow, director of production and training, Rosalind Fay, office manager, Susanna Hines, associate manager, Lindsay Goldsmith, production intern, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national advisor. And this show was written and produced by myself, Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.